You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look back at life in Wisconsin in the era of Prohibition. First, a proposal designed to prevent the creation of so-called super teams in Wisconsin high school sports was recently voted down. Essentially, it would have made it harder for students to transfer to another school for athletic reasons. The issue came into focus last year when a couple of top basketball recruits announced they were leaving Sun Prairie and transferring to Nicolet just outside of Milwaukee. Nicolet went on to win the Division II championship this past March. But the transfer proposal was rejected in a 239-150 vote in the WIAA amid concerns it was too vague and hard to enforce. But our guest says don't be surprised if this crops up again. Mark Stewart is the prep sports editor with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, yeah, sure. Hey, my pleasure.
Well, can you tell us a little more about why this issue of transfers is all of a sudden a hot story for the people who are making the rules for high school sports?
You know, a lot of it is, I think it basically kind of, the big spark was last spring. There were a couple of high-profile basketball players who decided they wanted to transfer to Nicolet High School. One kid was going from New Berlin West to Nicolet, and then there was another pair of brothers. Obviously, they would go to school together. Talented players, and their family moved from Sun Prairie into the Glendale School District, which is home to Nicolet. The big deal wasn't because transfers happen all the time, but the fact that you had, three Division I caliber players going to the same school, caught people's attention. And then, the fact that, one of the guys that they play with during the club season or the spring and summer, he was already at Nicolet. So it led to this thinking that, they're teaming up for a super team and things of that sort. And so that was kind of the spark, I think, to, this legislation that the WIAA tried to pass about a month or so ago.
And how do things work now, before, I guess, and after this plan was rejected? What's the rule if I'm a high school student, my family moves to a new high school? What do the rules say now?
Yeah, well, if you move into a new district, typically you are eligible. The key is that the move has to be a complete move. So, it can't be a situation where, you keep your house in Madison, but you move and get an apartment in Milwaukee or anything like that. The whole family has to move. So, it can't be a split situation. You and your father move or whatnot. So it has to be a full and complete move. But typically if you do that, and you move into a different district, then you become eligible for, to compete as a high school athlete. So that's the big thing. If you move and you don't have those conditions, then usually you have to sit out a calendar year from the time you enroll. The exceptions are if you are let's say you decide to change schools between your freshman and sophomore year, then you can gain eligibility at your new school automatically. So it's almost like the rule has one transfer written into it where you can kind of, a student can move freely and not and gain immediate eligibility at their new school.
So we had this proposal. As you said, it was rejected, but the idea was it was going to crack down some and make it a little harder. So what would the change have been here if this rule had passed?
The change would have been that, if you move into a new district, but that if you have some athletic tie with anyone at your new school, that you would still have to sit out a year. So let's say, two guys play together on a AAU team or a club team, one moves into the district, but he already has an AAU teammate there, for instance, then that person would still have to sit out a year. Or let's say, one of the coaches on staff, you know, with somebody you know that coached you during the summer or the club season, then you would have to sit out, you know, because of that previous relationship. So it really kind of opened the door to, you know, a lot of, I mean, you know, it opened the door to a lot, because what you realize, or what if people didn't realize this, is that, you know, everybody knows everybody. it's amazing. You know, you look in, you know, I'll be looking on Instagram, and you'll see, you know, this, you know, a standout basketball player from one part of the state. And then you see he's joking around with this football player who lives in a different part of the state, and it seems like they're buddy-buddy. And you're like, how did that happen? You know, so it opened up a can of worms that, you know, how are we judging relationships, and really, you know, how big of a deal is this that you need to go to these kinds of extent to crack down on a supposed problem.
Talking to Mark Stewart from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about high school sports, a proposal that was rejected by the state's main athletic organization for high schools. It would have made it harder to transfer from one school to another. The worry that students were meeting each other in programs and getting together and saying, hey, we'll move to the same place to try to form a super team. And this is going to sound alien, I think, to a lot of people, Mark, the idea that you'd up stakes and move to another high school just to be on a basketball team with somebody's, you know, teammates from a club. Do we have any kind of sense of how often this is actually happening?
To me, I thought this was kind of I didn't see the necessity of it, to be honest. I mean, usually what happens with, you know, a lot of the rules that you see come up the ranks from the WIAA is that, you know, there's, you know, a history of, you know, the problem existing to the point where, you know, a rule needs to be in place. You know, the current transfer rule that we just discussed a few minutes ago, you know, that rule came about because of years and years of kids transferring and it kind of creating some issues. Whereas in this case, a year ago, no one was even talking about transfers, and then all of a sudden, just because, you know, three or, you know, really two high-profile basketball players decide they want to go, you know, they and their family want to go to a different school, all of a sudden it becomes a big issue. When the reality is that, you know, transfers happen all the time. It's just the fact that, you know, in basketball, you know who the kids are, but I won't say names, but I could go to football, and there were kids who, for whatever reason, I'm not saying they're not legitimate reasons, but, you know, for family reasons, they moved from one school to another in the same conference. One year he's playing football for this team, the next year he's all conference for another team in the league. No one says anything about that, but the fact that, you know, it's these basketball guys, and they're recognized, and I don't know. I think there's always a little, you know, a level of, you know, distrust of basketball. That's just my impression of it. That I think it kind of put an unfair attention on those transfers, when the reality is that transfers happen all the time.
Is it a thing with basketball where, hey, three players, if they're starters, that's 60% of your starting lineup? Football, soccer, it's, you know, you need a lot more players to make a difference like that?
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. And, I mean, honestly, you know, basketball, when it comes to, you know, the high school sports in this day, you could, you know, argue that basketball is the most popular high school sport. But just because it's the most popular high school sport, or just because, you know, you got, you know, one or two standout athletes can make a huge difference, you know, shouldn't mean that just because you play those sports, you know, you should have, you know, this stigma attached to you moving from one school to another. You know, because the reality is that, you know, people move for various reasons. I mean, it's kind of a family decision. The rule kind of struck me as kind of crossing the line of, okay, you know, kind of being a governing body to high school sports, and then really kind of getting into people's business of, well, hey, well, why are you moving? You know, why are you moving? And then ultimately putting the WIAA in the position of saying, well, okay, now that you've explained why you moved, okay, you get a waiver, but you don't. I don't know. I don't know how it got that far. To me, it just opens up a can of worms that, you know, is going to would create a lot of headaches for people in the positions of having to explain why, you know, my transfer ultimately gets a waiver, but someone else's doesn't. You know, it just seemed like it was really completely unnecessary.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, I appreciate it. Anytime.
That was Mark Stewart, prep sports editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about the recent push by some in the WIAA to impose tighter transfer restrictions on high school student athletes so as not to create so-called super teams. That proposal was voted down at the annual meeting. Coming up next, Prohibition had a big impact on Wisconsin's culture and economy when it was put into place in the early 20th century. We'll get a taste of life in Wisconsin when alcohol was against the law. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the latest happenings in national politics, from a growing divide between the president and congressional Democrats to a recent push by some states to change how their electoral college votes work. First, for the past couple of weeks, WPR has been taking a closer look at the state's long relationship with alcohol, and we wanted to take a look back at a crucial period in the state's history, Prohibition. During the First World War and shortly thereafter, laws prohibiting the creation, sale, and consumption of alcohol took effect at the local and federal levels, and these laws had a big impact on the state's economy and culture. Our next guest is here to talk about the history of prohibition in the state and how Wisconsin highlights other social issues at the time, including anti-immigration and anti-suffrage movements. Carl Brown is an assistant professor of history at UW-Whitewater. Carl, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me on your show.
Well, Carl, in a way, I look back at Prohibition and I think, oh, they flipped a switch. One day alcohol is legal, the next day it's illegal. It kind of phased in, though, in reality, right?
Yeah, it's actually a much longer-term process. I mean, look, I think that most people think about Prohibition, they conjure up images of Carrie Nation wandering into bars and smashing, you know, things with their hatchet. And that's really only part of the story. As I see it, Prohibition is really more of kind of a perfect storm of a number of different causes. It goes back to the formation of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or WCTU, in 1873. It was like a grassroots movement of women trying to ban alcohol. And now, from where they're coming from, and you have to say that women didn't have the vote back then, so they identified alcohol as a source of many problems, you know, drunkenness, deadbeat dads, domestic abuse, and what have you. So it made a lot of sense for women to get on board with this project, right? I mean, they were able to sort of mobilize politically when they didn't have the vote yet. So they're doing various, so they're smashing up bars and whatnot throughout the 19th century. But then, but then 1893, the Anti-Saloon League is founded, and this is an actual lobbying group dedicated to passing laws banning alcohol. And what they used extensively was the local option, which was where individual cities or counties would ban alcohol consumption, production within their boundaries, right? So this is actually a really successful movement. By the eve of World War II, fully half of this country is already dry. So those are two longer-term causes. And then in the more short-term with World War I, what we see is both the restriction of supply of grain for breweries, because that grain should be used for bread for the war effort, but also this massive wave of anti-German sentiment is stoked by the U.S. government. And this ends up being directed or sort of channeled into the prohibition movement. There's really a lot of things going on in the years up to World War I that result in prohibition.
Now, Wisconsin famously had a big brewing industry, famously that was connected with German Americans in the state. So how did that combination of attitudes, anti-alcohol, anti-German immigrant, fit together?
Well, pretty horribly for Germans and brewers is the short answer. I mean, what you have is this anti-immigrant sentiment is stoked to the point where, I know here in Whitewater, the university stops offering German language courses in mid-1918. In Baraboo, they're actually taking German language textbooks out in the street and burning them, right? So there's a broad sort of popular anti-German sentiment that is that occurs during the war. And then brewers, for the most part, already have their supplies of grain reduced during the war itself. So then when Prohibition comes in afterwards, there's sort of a natural fusion of wartime anti-German sentiment sort of spilling over into a drive to close down these breweries. I mean, most of which are if you think about it, Pabst, you know, Bush, I mean, these are all owned by German Americans, right? So there's sort of a natural path, I would say, from the anti-German sentiment spurred during World War One, debouching onto the German breweries just after the war.
And I know you're interested in trying to debunk some myths about Prohibition. What kind of myths do you see persisting in Wisconsin and beyond?
Thanks, Rob. Good question. As I see it, there are two major myths here. The first is that this is all because of Carrie Nation and her, you know, crazy woman with hatchet smashing up bars. The other is sort of this broader issue of like whether Prohibition worked or not. I think that most people, if you asked them, they'd say it didn't work, right? People kept on drinking in speakeasies, what have you. But if you take a sort of a broader big picture view of the thing in terms of public policy, it was a dramatic success. I mean, American alcohol consumption rates don't come back to their 1915 levels until the 1970s. You know, I mean, by the late 1920s, Americans are drinking roughly a third what they were in 1915. So if we look at the basic level of did Americans drink less, that is true. Now, if we look at sort of broader questions of did this also spur organized crime, did a lot of people go blind or die from drinking bad alcohol, well, this also is true. But I mean, long story short, I think that if we judge this public policy in terms of its basic metric outcomes, did people drink less? The answer is yes, absolutely, for generations afterwards.
Talking to Carl Brown, assistant professor of history at UW-Whitewater, looking back at Prohibition-era Wisconsin. Carl, another aftermath, obviously the alcohol industry, even after Prohibition ended, I assume looked very different than it did before Prohibition. What kind of changes happened?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the striking things about Prohibition is that it was pretty much the death of many small breweries, small regional breweries who have been competing with the big ones. You know, AB and Tabs are the major American breweries going into the period. But when they're forced to close their door, so some breweries are able to switch to making other commodities, ice cream, malt syrups, and near beer, things like that. And the bigger breweries have enough financial resources that they can pretty much wait out Prohibition. The smaller ones don't really have that option, and as a result, most of them never come back after Prohibition. So if you look at sort of like the broader scheme of brewery conglomeration over the course of the 19th century into the 20th, what we see is Prohibition actually helped the big breweries once beer is legalized once more, because much of their competition has been cleared out or fallen by the wayside since.
When we think back about Prohibition, we think about the ways people got around it. You mentioned speakeasies earlier, corruption, crime. What did things look like in Wisconsin? Were at least some breweries able to game the system?
Some were, at least for a short amount of time. What I found, I was looking in the National Archives in Chicago a couple weeks back at the history of Prohibition Wisconsin, and I found most breweries, you know, stopped brewing and started playing by the rules right when the Volstead Amendment goes into effect, right? But I also found some fascinating cases where breweries kept on brewing into 1920, even 1921. Most notably, Rahr Brewing up in Green Bay, I think, they kept brewing since 1920. And then when they finally got brought to trial, they were hit with, you know, 50 different counts of selling kegs and cases of beer to various different local bars, as well as local Elks Club, oddly enough, which I think suggests that there was still a fair bit of illicit brewing going on, at least early in Prohibition. Now, over time, even the breweries had to stop down, had to close their operations.
Now, you mentioned the role of women in the anti-saloon movement, in the temperance movement. Of course, the suffrage movement is going along. How did the role of women change during and maybe because of Prohibition?
Sure. Well, the first place, there's been some interesting research lately on how the breweries actually funded and sponsored the anti-temperance movement. Their concern was that if women got the vote, they would vote to get rid of alcohol. And they were right. I mean, as I mentioned, many women activists saw the saloon and drinking as the source of many social ills, and the one way they had to mobilize against it was in the temperance movement. So the striking thing that happens with Prohibition is that, I mean, prior to Prohibition, saloons were very much male-coded spaces, right? It was only men and respectable women, certainly, that would go and drink in public. But once Prohibition comes along, you've got speakeasies and everybody's drinking illegally. Well, in many places, Wisconsin and elsewhere, what you have are speakeasies that close down, and the next day they open up as so-called soda parlors, which are still selling alcohol under the counter, but there's no reason to keep women from them, right? So prohibition basically breaks down this sort of like gender division of drinking, where public drinking, where it does take place, albeit illicitly, is a much more gender neutral phenomenon. Women also are able to drink in public.
Now, some of our commenters online have drawn the analogy often made between modern-day marijuana issues and alcohol prohibition about a century ago. Do you see any analogies?
Absolutely, absolutely, 100%. Because if you look at prohibition prior to World War I, this is very much a sort of a patchwork image of the U.S., right? One county is dry, next one over is wet. So if you're in that county that's dry, and you want to get a drink, what do you do?
You go next door to the county, one county over, I imagine.
Exactly right. And I think that the same thing is happening with marijuana today, is that as individual states legalize and other states hold off on doing so, well, the ones that are legalizing are doing so for whatever set of reasons and with whatever set of concerns in mind. But if it's legal, you know, a 10 or 15 or 2 hour minute drive away, attempts at control upon your consumption or behavior simply don't matter anymore, right? I mean, there's I think, a direct parallel with what the U.S. looked like prior to formal prohibition, when, again, half of the U.S. is already dry, but people can drive, you know, next door to get their liquor, and the current status of affairs in this country, where I think almost half of the states have either medical or legal marijuana laws in effect, and even if where you live doesn't allow that, you can drive a few hours and take care of your desires.
We'll leave it there for now, Carl. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Cheers, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Carl Brown, Assistant Professor of History at UW-Whitewater. He joined us today to talk about the history of prohibition in Wisconsin and the social and economic impact it had in the state. You can find all of our stories in our High Tolerance series on Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. Go online to wpr.org/alcohol. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the growing battle between congressional Democrats and President Trump in our weekly roundup of national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on negotiations over school funding in the Wisconsin state budget. First, it's time for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. A battle is brewing across the country over new laws restricting abortion, including proposals here in Wisconsin. Elsewhere, Nevada is poised to join a growing number of states looking to change the way electoral votes are handled in presidential elections. And back in Congress, House Democrats and President Trump are squaring off once again, this time over the issue of subpoenas. Here's House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler speaking after former White House counsel Don McGahn did not show up for his questioning on Tuesday.
When this committee issues a subpoena, even to a senior presidential advisor, the witness must show up. Our subpoenas are not optional.
That's leading to new calls from Democrats and one Republican for impeachment investigations or proceedings to begin. Our question this week, would you like to see congressional Democrats begin impeachment investigations against the president or impeachment charges? Why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Well, Reed, I want to touch on what happened at the White House a little earlier today. Democrats and President Trump were set to meet to talk about infrastructure. Things apparently didn't go well. Here's the president talking about why he cut off talks after just a few minutes.
Senator Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, I want to do infrastructure. I want to do it more than you want to do it. I'd be really good at that. That's what I do. But you know what? You can't do it under these circumstances. So get these phony investigations over with.
Part of that was due to what Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi had to say earlier today. Here's a listen.
Would you believe that it's important for to follow the facts We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States, and we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
All right, Reid, dramatic, in some cases puzzling events today. What do you make of all this?
This is part of a long cycle that's been really ramping up in just the last couple of weeks, in which House Democrats are increasingly calling on the Speaker of the House and House Democratic leaders to open impeachment investigations, an impeachment inquiry, I think is the technical term, into President Trump. President Trump is clearly getting more and more agitated by this as his administration is blocking or refusing to comply with subpoenas and requests for documents from Congress. Congress has won a couple of battles in court so far over the last, just the last few days even. And so the tension here in Washington just feels like it's rising to a point at which something is going to break. Either the House Dems are going to open some kind of impeachment inquiry, or nothing is going to get done. I mean, shock and surprise, nothing gets done in Washington, D.C. But President Trump is clearly so agitated that he's going to suspend talks on what would be maybe the only big bipartisan win that Congress and the president could come up with this year.
And Reid, Democrats are calling for different things. Some are saying, hey, let's actually start an impeachment process. Some, probably more of them, are saying, no, let's start an impeachment inquiry, where they try to do an investigation and round up their multiple committee investigations into one, you know, looking at a potential impeachment. Do you have a sense of how many are on either side of that kind of subtle difference?
Well, it's changing by the hour. I mean, the news conference that Speaker Pelosi held after the House Dem meeting this morning was the latest twist. As you know, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler sort of gave an update in just a few minutes to the House Dems. And basically what we're seeing from leadership is they're trying to hold back this tide, the growing tide, I should say, of Democrats who are calling for a serious impeachment inquiry or just flat out impeaching the president. And I think what at least somewhat emerging consensus from that group is that they ought to create that impeachment inquiry so that the five major committees that are looking into President Trump can consolidate their inquiries into one area, which would be the House Judiciary Committee. And that Judiciary Committee then investigating and issuing subpoenas left and right would have more legal standing to actually force the White House to disclose those documents. And I think that sort of argument about legal standing is what's going to lead to an impeachment inquiry if we get there.
Democrats and one Republican, Justin Amash of Michigan, a congressman, founder of a very conservative caucus within, or co-founder of a conservative caucus within the House, gotten a lot of attention, a lot of anger from fellow Republicans. Is he going to be a one and only, or is he a tip of the iceberg, Reid?
Well, Justin Amash has always been something of an iconoclast within the party. He's from the sort of Ron Paul libertarian wing of the party, and he is one of those guys who frequently voted no on bills that the Republican leadership brought up when they were in control, and frequently votes against everything, frankly. He is probably one of the only Republicans who's actually read the entire Mueller report himself, and he tweeted his conclusions over the weekend. We haven't seen any other calls for the impeachment from Republicans yet, or at least inquiries into an impeachment. Although I will say Senator Mitt Romney from Utah over the weekend called Justin Amash's position brave.
Talking to Reid Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's bring on a caller on the potential impeachment issue at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Three things. No, I don't believe they should do this impeachment. Two, they need to replace Pelosi. And three, if they actually start the process, you're pretty much handing Trump 2020 election. I'm almost feeling that the right is just basically baiting them, just daring them to do this, because it's going to cost the Democrat Party so much political capital on it. And it's going to really screw up the 2020 campaign for their candidates. So,
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. And Reid, Nancy Pelosi has raised that concern that the president might be baiting them to start the impeachment process. That is something that's clearly weighing on her mind, the political, potential political fallout if they pursue impeachment.
Yeah, and yet, on the other hand, there is Congress's responsibility to conduct oversight. It's, you know, in the Constitution, the Congress gets the oversight of the executive branch, and it's got, they've got the investigative powers. So the Dems who are arguing for impeachment are saying, look, we've got to do this, otherwise we are ceding even more power to the executive branch, which has been a trend basically since Nixon and Watergate. The power has been bleeding away from Congress and towards the White House. This is the Democrats' opportunity to claw some of that power back. And, you know, whether or not this actually becomes a political boon to President Trump, I'm not sure that is that fully accounts for what an impeachment inquiry would look like. You can imagine that if you and I talk during an impeachment inquiry, we're not going to be talking about anything else. And that's what's going to dominate the cable news coverage. It's going to be the front page of the newspaper every day. And Democrats will have the ability to air the full, not just the full Mueller report, but basically everything else they want to investigate, too. It's going to be, you know, 6 or 9 months or however long they decide to take of drip, drip, drip about President Trump and his conduct. And, you know, that's not going to look very good. It didn't look very good for Richard Nixon, obviously. Bill Clinton was sort of a different case, I'd argue, because of what he had been impeached for. But, you know, there is as much of a downside to President Trump as a potential downside for House Democrats and the Democratic Party at large, too.
Now, impeachment aside, House Democratic committees have a lot going on. For one, they subpoenaed Don McGahn, former White House counsel, to come to a hearing in front of the House Judiciary Committee. The White House said, don't do it. Can you talk about what is behind this and where we are on that?
Right. So Don McGahn, of course, was the key source, sort of played the narrator role in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. He is now a private citizen. He's back at his old law firm here in Washington, D.C., and he has been instructed by the White House not to talk to Congress and not to obey the subpoena on the basis of executive privilege, which is the provision that the court is sort of the court precedent that allows a president's advisors not to turn over documents in order to be sure that they can give him candid advice, behind closed doors. It's not clear to me whether executive privilege applies to a former staffer. It's not clear to me whether executive privilege applies to somebody who's, you know, said something for a document that is now for sale on Amazon.com and sitting on a lot of bookshelves around the country. But this is the moment, I think, when Don McGahn declined to obey the subpoena or comply with the subpoena, that House Dems switched from being agitated with the slow response from the White House to starting to openly talk about impeachment. Nancy Pelosi herself mentioned that one of the three articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon was his failure to comply with the request of Congress.
And another story you alluded to earlier, congressional committees trying to get hold of some of Donald Trump's, as a private citizen, financial records, tax records, bank records. We've seen a couple court rulings now, one saying, yep, his accountant should provide records. Now we're hearing Deutsche Bank and I think Capital One. A judge says, yep, they can supply those records despite a suit from President Trump trying to stop that. What are members of Congress looking for there?
Well, they're looking for a couple of different things. The House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richard Neal, who's a Democrat from Massachusetts, has been looking for the last 6 years of President Trump's personal and business of the financial records. In part, they say, to make sure there's no interference or influence from overseas organizations or overseas governments. And they have been stymied. They have tried to use a law that's about a century old to force the IRS to disclose President Trump's taxes. That law says very clearly that Congress is able to do that. The Treasury Department, Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, has said he is not able to comply with that. That's going to go to the courts real quick, and it's hard to see how the administration is going to be able to defend that one, especially because the Washington Post has reported that the IRS, in an internal memo, has even said that there's really nothing they can do, and they have to turn over the documents that have been requested by Congress. So this is, again, a part of the continued pattern. President Trump has promised to defy all subpoenas that have come from Congress. The courts are now starting to say, sorry, you can't do that. A couple of weeks ago, people were throwing around the phrase constitutional crisis. We're not in that yet because we're at a moment where the executive branch and the legislative branch are at a loggerheads, and we have a system to deal with that. It's called the judicial branch. It's the third branch of government. They are just now beginning to weigh in. The problem and the thing that frustrates Democrats so much is that it takes a long time for a court case to get from a district court. Those district courts have been ruling against President Trump so far, up to a circuit court, and then eventually, of course, to the U.S. Supreme Court. A negative ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court was basically what forced Richard Nixon out of office. You know, we'll see if President Trump has enough time left in office to get to that that point, if it were to come, given the 2020 elections that are right around the corner.
It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Reed Wilson is with us, national correspondent for The Hill. Still time for you to weigh in on the issue of impeachment or an impeachment inquiry. Growing number of Democrats say we should do one or the other, and one Republican, too. House leadership still not on board, Democratic House leadership. What do you think? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. We're talking about some of the top news stories in national politics, including the big standoff in Congress between House Democrats and the president. Let's bring on one more caller on the impeachment issue. Roxy is with us in Madison. Roxy, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think?
I believe they should wait on that impeachment and even talking about it. And they should just take care of the American people, because I believe, and I used to be a staunch Democrat, really, really strong Democrat, but I hate to tell them this, I believe they're all going to be in for a rude awakening, because I think when the rug gets picked up and shaken out, I think there's going to be a lot of egg on a lot of Democrats' face. I think they ought to just sit back and wait, because there's a lot of things going on, and I myself personally believe that Mueller is as dirty as a couple of the other people. I'm sorry, but I truly, truly believe that Mueller is dirty.
Roxy, thanks for the call. And there's a case that a lot of Republicans and the president are making themselves read that, hey, what the investigation should be about, the investigation. We should be looking at what started it, what the FBI did, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant distraction that the Republicans have brought up. There are a lot of these stories that border on conspiracy theory about who did what when and. Bottom line, I find it very hard to believe, having watched Robert Mueller as FBI director for 12 years, the longest stint second longest stint in the history of the FBI, and the only person after J. Edgar Hoover that Congress trusted to be in office longer than the 10 years the term limited the FBI director has. I have a hard time believing that he's anything but the upstanding prosecutor and sort of rock-ribbed Republican law and order type guy that he was depicted as for the 12 years that he was in office, first appointed by George W. Bush, then appointed by Barack Obama. So, the level of conspiracy theory conversation around all this, I think, is designed as a smokescreen to obfuscate the actual serious investigation that he did. And I'll point out, by the way, that Robert Mueller himself has not jumped into the limelight. He is concerned about testifying in public in Congress because he doesn't want to be seen as political. We have not heard a word out of Robert Mueller in public since he became special counsel, 2 years ago now.
Thanks for that call, Roxy. Let's move on to some issues outside of Congress now, Reed. On Tuesday, we saw protests around the country aimed at a series of laws passed by states in recent weeks to restrict access to abortions. A lot of states changing their laws in one direction or another. Can you talk about how we got here and why now?
Yeah, this is a really interesting change in strategy for the pro-life community, the anti-abortion rights community. Basically, since Justice Brett Kavanaugh took his seat on the Supreme Court, the anti-abortion rights pro-life groups have started taking up this cause of passing legislation that obviously flies in the face of the precedent the Supreme Court set with Roe v. Wade. They know that these laws are going to be challenged in court. In fact, they are all challenged immediately in court. And the moment they are, that's a feature, not a bug, for these pro-life groups. They want this, these court cases to end up before the Supreme Court, where they now believe there is a an anti-Roe pro-life majority that will strike down the precedent set back in the 1970s with Roe v. Wade. Just this year, there have been six states that have passed laws that are meant to be legal challenges to Roe v. Wade. In most recently, we've seen these pass in Alabama, in Georgia, in Missouri, and of course, there's an effort to do so in Wisconsin as well, although Governor Tony Evers said that he's going to veto that legislation. So this is all an effort to get this thing into the courts. For the longest time, the pro-life side has not thought that they could actually win legal challenges. So they designed measures to picket abortion rights around the edges, to limit clinic access or strengthen rules or something like that. Now they see the possibility of winning an actual legal challenge, and so they're going to the courts.
Now, Republican political leaders are weighing in on this issue publicly. A lot of Democratic presidential candidates showed up at some of these protests this week. Do you see this abortion being maybe a bigger issue, a more high-profile issue in the presidential election than it may have been in some past ones?
Well, abortion is always kind of an issue in presidential elections. It is one of the clearest issues that divides Democrats and Republicans. You've got to go back to, Johnson or Kennedy to find the last pro-life Democrat and the last pro-choice Republican. Probably got to go back farther than that. The issue, you know, in this time when we've seen sea changes in public opinion on marijuana legalization and gay marriage and the really hot button cultural issues, the polling on abortion has been amazingly stable for about the last 40 years. You know, a larger percentage of Americans believe that abortion should be legal in some cases, but not all, than those who think it should be illegal in all cases. But those numbers are really static, and they have been over time.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill in our weekly roundup of national politics. One more story before we're done. Reed, the state of Nevada this week passed legislation that would give the state's electoral college votes to the winner of the national popular vote. That's if that is signed by the governor. This is part of a multi-state process, right?
Right. Nevada would become the 15th state to sign the so-called National Popular Vote Compact. And what this would do is it does not end the Electoral College. It simply finds a way legally to circumvent the Electoral College. There is nothing in the Constitution that gives you or I the right to vote for President of the United States. It gives that the right to choose the electors to the Electoral College to the states. Now, every state has decided to give their citizens the right to vote, but that takes a legal process. So what would happen under this National Popular Vote Compact, if enough states sign up and they need to get to 270 electoral votes, which is what you need to actually win the White House for this compact to take effect, is that those states would require their electors, the people elected to the Electoral College, to vote for the winner of the overall national popular vote, regardless of who actually won their state. So hypothetically, if President Trump wins the state of Wisconsin by 100,000 votes, but the Democratic nominee to be named later ends up winning the national popular vote, then Wisconsin's electoral votes would go to the Democratic winner as opposed to the incumbent Republican president, and you know, vice versa if those scenarios are reversed. But the goal here is to circumvent the Electoral College. There's no way to eliminate the Electoral College without doing it through the Constitution. Of course, doing it through the Constitution is a really hard thing to do that has barely happened in American history. And so this is the legal way to get around it without changing the Constitution.
So we're at 195 if Nevada joins in on this idea. Do you see a lot more states lining up to maybe get this idea of the popular vote being the decider to get that up to 270 anytime soon?
Well, there are a number of states that have taken it up, and the most interesting thing that I watched this year was the number of Republican states that debated the bill, the similar version of the bill, maybe passed it through one of their two legislative chambers, but it didn't quite make it all the way. We saw efforts in states like Arizona, states like Oklahoma. I mean, these are, you know, some of the most conservative states in the country. And what the Republicans who like this idea will tell you is that the demographics of key swing states do not favor their party in the long term. So they got to figure out a new way to win elections based on the popular vote. Of course, the pushback is, well, we won the White House twice without winning the popular vote, both in 2016 and in 2000. Why mess with what's working? The problem for Republicans is what's working isn't going to work all the time, and they're going to scream bloody murder if the opposite happens to them, if a Democrat wins the White House without winning the popular vote. So at the end of the day, the debate in Republican states has been a little bit stymied because President Trump won the way he did.
And thanks to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. He joined us for our weekly look at some of the latest news in national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the impeachment idea. You can tweet us, as always, at Central Time WPR. The Milwaukee Bucks are now tied up in their conference finals after the Raptors won two games in Toronto. That has Bucks fans upset, but what's bugging people more, Toronto celebrity Drake courtside with the opposing team. Associate producer Lucas Johnson has thoughts. Hey, Lucas.
Hey, Rob.
So what do you think as you observe Drake and his sideline bling?
Well, I think there's a big difference between being a passionate and supportive fan and kind of shining the spotlight on yourself, which I think Drake's doing. I think whether he thinks so or not, the players aren't really concerned about getting a handshake from him after being called out of the game. Their mind is more so focused on the game.
So he's getting up and standing right there. It looks like he's on the bench with the team. He's not technically. He's giving the coach a back rub during the game, right? I mean, isn't this against the rules? I don't know.
It is. If you look at the NBA fan conduct policy, it is against the rules. And I think there are a lot of other examples of perennial celebrity fans who support teams, people like Spike Lee, people like Jack Nicholson, who stay in their seats, applaud the team, and show their love without getting involved.
Well, Lucas, thanks for joining the show. And we'll go out not with the music of Drake, but with a Milwaukee band who has advice on Drake's future attendance at basketball games.